Okay, the point of this session is so the speakers can have a dialogue between each other for 5 or 10 minutes, and then it's open to questions again from the tables. So let's start then with our first speaker, who will engage our second speaker in a dialogue.
Okay, I'm ready. You know, there's this nice study by Bill Banks where he was trying to figure out whether things that happened after you acted had an effect on, your judgments about when you did things or when you felt intentions and the like. And the way he did it was this. It was a Libet paradigm. And so, you flex your wrist whenever you want and you report on things. You report on the clock. Where you thought the spot was when you first felt your intention. And then in some cases, there was no tone after the wrist flexion. And in some cases, there was a tone 5 milliseconds later, sometimes 10, and sometimes 20, and sometimes 40, I think it was. And what he discovered is that the later the tone, the later your estimate of where the spot was on the clock when you first felt your intention. So that, this after the action event had an effect on judgments about things that happened earlier. And that just seemed to fit right in with the sort of thing you were talking about, and I wondered whether you would find that kind of experiment useful.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that particular experiment, but definitely that makes sense. And the studies on intentional binding that Patrick has done a lot. So this intentional binding effect is that when you make an action and there's an outcome, so you press a key and then you hear a beep, and a bunch of studies have shown that your subjective experience of the time between the action and the beep is shorter when you cause the beep to happen, so when you press the key and you hear the beep, then if you're just pressing the key or if you're just hearing the beep, or when you're actually feeling out of control. So essentially when you feel in control, it seems like the subjective time between the action and the outcome is reduced. And that's suggested to come from, trying to bind these two things together in your mind so that you get the causal relationship. So the idea of the contingency, the time contingency being important. And what's very interesting about these studies is that they indeed show that you can have a shift of the perceived time of the action towards the outcome, and then a shift of the perceived time of the outcome towards the action. And for example, whether the outcome happens or not can change your perception of when the action happened. Mm-hmm. And so that's interesting because then it seems to, in that study that you mentioned, it seems to even change the time of the intention. I wonder in which direction, if it was in the direction of pulling more
It was in the
action.
Direction of the tone, yeah. The further out the tone in time, though.
So then I think that's consistent with the fact that you then shift the time, your perceived time of your intention and your action towards the outcome. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting because it's showing these retrospective influences on your perception of what happened before.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think it has to do with the integration of information.
Neera, do you have a question for Alfred?
Did I have a question? Well, I mean, I think I thought about making a comment since it was mentioned this idea of free will that Benjamin Libe suggested if we don't have free will, but we might still have free will. But actually, from a deterministic viewpoint, you could equally find brain activity that predicts the decision that you're you're going to decide not to do something. And indeed, some of my colleagues have shown that you can find brain precursors to the decision not to do something. Although it's a lot harder to find because of the issues that Al mentioned, mm-hmm. of finding the time at which the action would have been supposed to happen, and so on. So that's just a side point. But otherwise, I think discussing the free will issue and avoiding the definitions seems to me kind of complicated because that seems to be the key issue. So I think the disagreement of the neuroscientists with the notion of free will stems from them taking a particular view of what free will means. And I think maybe the issue is that they're taking a view which is not necessarily the view that even most people think or that is relevant to have. So maybe instead of scientists saying that we don't have any free will, which they a lot of people are saying. I think what science can help us do is figure out, well, what will do we have? What freedom do we have? What can we do? How can we understand this process? So that I think the definition aspect of it seems pretty critical.
Yeah, I agree with that. So one thing I have discovered is that some scientists think that free will requires immaterial souls.
Exactly.
And so they can hear my kind of reply to, you know, the sort of thing I did today, and then they can say, yeah, but still we have strong evidence that there's no free will because our evidence is that the brain is doing this and there's no room for souls, so there's no free will. So now there, you're asking a question about a definition. So how are you going to define free will? Are you going to define it in such a way that it includes souls, requires souls, or, you know, define it in different ways? Now, one thing philosophers spend a lot of time doing is generating definitions. So we are sort of experts at this. And but now how do you convince a scientist that he should define free will the way you do? Instead of the way he wants to do it. So what I do, I mean, and I've written papers about this too, is we get to the point in our discussions with scientists, so why do you think that free will requires souls? Why do they depend on souls? Where do you get that idea? And, you know, the scientist might think about it for a while and think, damn, I don't know, I just always thought that. You know, so it's just, it's his opinion or her opinion. And so then I say, well, you know, I think of it differently. Let's try to find a neutral audience. And then I go out and I do survey studies. It's called experimental philosophy. I'll tell you about one. You'll see how it goes. So the story is this. It's a certain year in the future, and scientists have finally discovered and proved that everything is physical. There's nothing non-physical. This is the story the subjects hear. And then just to make the point sink in, so intentions and decisions are brain events, and they're caused by other brain events, which are caused by other things. Then John Jones sees a $20 bill fall out of the pocket of the person in front of him. He thinks about returning it, but he decides to keep it. Did John have free will at the time? And now if the subjects are tracking the story, and if they think, well, geez, he doesn't have a soul, right? Everything's physical, so he doesn't, then the majority of subjects would say no. But the majority say yes. And it's about three quarters who say yes. So, and, you know, I do study after study like this. Other people do them. I have control studies where we look at something else. And then I can come back to scientists and say, okay, well, you don't know why you think that free will requires souls. I know why I think it doesn't. And we looked at the neutral audience, and they go with me. So what happens now? What do scientists do now? Do they say, well, I'm going to define free will the way I want to define it anyway? There's nothing I can do about it. There isn't any definition police force, right? So,
yeah.
But I agree about that, what Neera said about that. Also about the veto power. Libet was a person who thought that free will required something like souls, conscious forces that had no physical substrate. And what he wanted to do was to find evidence that consciousness could sort of swoop in from outside the physical order and do something or other. And he thought his experiments showed that consciousness couldn't initiate actions, but he was hoping to show that consciousness could swoop in and shut down a process that was about to happen, shut down actions. So right, he was looking for veto power in a way that would require souls. And the way I think of veto power, it's just the ability to stop yourself from acting on an urge. It doesn't require a soul. And we do have that. We do have that kind of power. Now whether that's enough for free won't or free will depends on what you mean by free will.
Yeah.
And I mentioned earlier, I have a couple of different meanings of free will to offer people. I try not to be restrictive. I have two that I like, and neither one requires anything supernatural.
Yeah, I feel like that's really the issue for scientists, and maybe the problem in the discussion of free will is the dualistic view of Descartes, that you have to have something outside of the world, outside of, you know, the physical world to control the world. But actually, if you take a monistic view where there's just one thing, there is just the body and the brain, and then there's, I guess, also complexity, and, you know, then you don't need to invoke an external thing. So
yeah.
But yeah.
Okay, I think that's really interesting, because it comes right back to our law and how we deal with problems like this. There have been numerous articles on the neuropsychiatric literature as to how much people, when they get to court, have free will. In fact, when somebody hits somebody and has a terrible childhood, does that mean that he doesn't have free will? And of course, the courts are pragmatic about that. That's easy. What about when you injure somebody from a sleepwalking episode? Did you have free will then or not? And there are arguments for and against. And so on the whole, the courts will say different things about that, because they're now split. In Canada, they will say, yes, they do. They don't have free will, let them go into the general public, whereas in this country we say they ought to go into a medium secure unit. And then, of course, the one where it's clearly automatic are people who injure somebody during an epileptic seizure. Then the courts are very clear on this, and they say that person has no responsibility for this, so we ought to look after him until he gets responsibility. And so they suggest possibly a secure unit. So the law is very graded on this, but I think it's enormously interesting that these decisions all become pragmatic. We forget, in fact, about our philosophers and our neuroscientists. We're pragmatists. Okay, let's open this up. And Beata, yeah, you wanted to say something.
If I can just add, I think neuroscience doesn't really change. I mean, neuroscientists have come around to say, oh, we don't have any free will because of this evidence of Libet and so on. But actually, the underlying argument, which is the determinism is incompatible with free will, has been around for a long time. And sociology had already shown how our context, how the social environment we grow up in, changes a lot our capacity to make some decisions. So it's actually not really news. It's just posed as if it's
news. Not new at all. It's been there ever since the beginning, really. Where's Beata?
Here I am.
Have you got a mic? Yes.
Yes, I have. This really links up to what David told us about his miraculous experience at St. Andrews. I am not a golfer, I'm a writer. And it has happened to me more than once that I was working on a piece that mattered to me enormously, and suddenly it began to flow, and it just went on and on until it ended, and it wrote it. I didn't. Because when I read it afterwards, I was genuinely surprised. Did I really write this? So my question, which is half comment, half question, is where did this come from? There was no intention. I mean, the basic intention was that I had a deadline and I had to write a piece. But there was no intention of it suddenly doing it for me.
Yeah.
You want to go there?
I'd suggest that it is just itself. So you have this intention to write and then things follow from each other. It's a bit like the improvisation in jazz or something like that. I mean, the situation defines itself and defines the next possible steps. So I don't know if one needs to invoke another agent that isn't you can't just account for the next action of writing the next word by the fact that the previous words were written and that you have general ideas in your head about how things might go. Sure, sure. Yeah.
Where do I keep this? Because I can't access it at will.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think deadlines are a really powerful way of triggering that. But otherwise, I don't know where it is. I guess it's just somewhere in you.
Okay, Diana.
Hello. I'd like your comments on two related phenomena. One is post-hypnotic suggestion. It is entirely possible that a hypnotist could program me whenever David or Peter speaks, to rush out of the room. If I were interviewed about this, I would claim it. I would produce a credible reason. I would say, oh, I was feeling a bit dizzy, or I suddenly needed to check the messages on my phone, something. So I would claim agency for something that was clearly I had really nothing to do with. On the other hand, another hypnotic phenomenon, of course, is to give people agency where they feel they have none, with compulsions, for instance. You make the compulsion conscious, you give them the opportunity of free won't. But I'd also like to mention, in terms of the legal system, how the occasions where people with compulsions claim the absence of agency, such that the woman who has bankrupted her family through compulsive gambling is able to take legal action against the casino to say, you should have realized I am completely helpless and you have exploited me. I would like your comments on those phenomena.
Okay. Well, I'll say something about it. In philosophy, we have a lot of thought experiments, and a stock example of somebody who's acting unfreely is the hypnotized subject. And right, they do confabulate a reason for doing what they're doing, and they're wrong. And yeah, so we treat them as acting unfreely. Another stock example is the kind of person who really is compelled to do a thing. And we tend to talk about compulsive hand washers or something like that, you know, a pretty serious condition. So they're stock examples of unfree action. Now, we also have cases, just thought experiments. We make this stuff up. We're good at making stuff up. Where you induce a desire in someone, like your case, and it's hard to resist, but it's resistible. And what do we think about those cases? Well, there you get some division. Some people think, oh, that person is acting unfreely because you gave him a desire that's hard to resist. And other people think, well, look, you gave him the desire, but he can resist it, and so, you know, he's acting freely. You know, these are all things we try to sort out, but it's difficult business. It's part of the definition issue. Mm. You know, does your definition count those guys as free or unfree?
Yeah, and I'd like to add as well the issue of the degrees of freedom, and that I think the law is really very attentive to that, to the fact that people can have different degrees of freedom in the decisions that they're making and different degrees of responsibility that they should be assigned depending on the condition. And so, yeah, having a prepotent or a need or urge might be important in terms of reducing the penalties or whatever that people might suffer. So I think, and it's also interesting that the legal system does seem to value quite a lot people's experience of agency and the experience of having intentions to do something. So that whether you had an intention to harm somebody or not is critical to how a crime is dealt with. And so I think that's quite interesting. I don't know what else I want to
say. Thank you.
You first, then Tuvi, then you, and that's the lot.
I wanted to make a rather academic, but I think important point. When people use the word soul, there are at least two very different traditions. Because when Plato and Descartes use the word soul, it is of a sort of supernatural, separate entity. But in the Hebrew tradition of nefesh, it's an animation of the body. And in a similar way, they're not quite the same. When Aristotle talks about the soul, it's not a separate thing. It's a way of talking about how an organism, because of the interrelatedness of the parts, transcends any notion of a pile of stones or something like that. So when we say, does it demand a soul? There's two very different contexts. And I think in the Cartesian or Platonic sense, free will does not demand a soul. But it might well, in this much more subtle, I think, Aristotelian or Hebrew sense, of a complex whole that cannot be defined adequately without taking into account the interrelationship of the parts, which gives a certain kind of transcendence to the mechanistic.
I agree. I mean, soul in that second sense is compatible with physicalism, with everything being physical. So I agree. It's just that the second sense isn't used much these days, but it's certainly there. I wrote my dissertation on Aristotle, by the way. It was a long time ago.
We use the term first entelechy.
Yeah.
Okay,
thank you. Thank you. Just before my question, just a comment about the previous comment. In Kabbalah, they're talking about five levels of what you call soul, which is not just one. Nefesh is the lowest one, which is like in the body, in the blood. But there is five levels. It's very interesting. And each one is more and more subtle. And the upper one is called Yechidah, which is the oneness, which is like a soul of the universe. So it's five levels, starting from myself and upper level up the universe. This is just a comment. But it's related very much to my main question and comment. We are focused now, especially in the last two sessions which were interesting, in the agency of myself. And all of them because you've got intention. And the intention is to start with purpose to do something. My question is, if we are only one who has got intention and purpose, or there is also purpose in the universe, we are only part of nature. So my question is, if the same way of the intention to do something for the future, there is not just in ourselves, in the universe, and how these things related. And it's related also to what David gave an example. Is it the golf is just himself doing it, or when Mozart write some music, is it just coming from himself, or when you write a poem or something, is coming from, and is there like two level of or more than one level of consciousness? One that I feel, it's and I'm aware, and there is also a higher level of consciousness or eye of the universe, and they've also got intention that maybe we're not aware, and purpose, and those two things can be related. So the agency can be, in the same way I can say, heart is part of me, my heart has got a purpose, he knows exactly how to pump and when to pump, I don't to think about this, the same is my lung, but if I want, I can change the pace of my heart, my breathing, consciously. The same we can see that we are part of a bigger consciousness, that each one of us can make some decision on our own, but on the other hand, we can think ourselves as part of a much more universal consciousness or intelligence that also have got some decision that give
okay,
us some freedom.
Okay, Tuvi, we're going to have to move on because we're getting very close to time. So is that a comment or is it
no,
a question?
No, my question, what do you think about this? Or the intention beyond ourselves?
Okay, have you two a reply.
I find the idea very interesting, but for me, it's always the question always is, okay, what's the evidence for that? And then once I see the evidence, I can make a sort of judgment. Is it a possibility? Sure it is, and it's an interesting possibility.
Okay, let's leave it there and come on to our last question.
She wants to add.
Sorry.
If I can just add another point, which is, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I would also have the same sort of approach. I don't know quite how to think about that. But I do think that there is also an important role to think about society and interaction between people. And that shapes dramatically how we're experiencing things. And so I don't know if that's one mechanism by which one can get to a sort of different level. But I don't know how to think about it.
So. Okay, a quick last question.
I have two comments or questions. We have not heard any kind of discussion on correlation versus causal relationship. Mm-hmm. So many neuroscientists take immediately a correlation to support the content this being a causal relationship. And the other thing is that they also say normally that bottom-up relation causals are the only one they accept and they use in their explanations. But from consciousness, we have it's so complex. And there, even materialist physicalists, they should have no problem in thinking about each level of complexity in an organism has separate rules which cannot be explained completely by the lower levels. Like biochemistry cannot be explained completely by physics. And a person cannot be explained completely just by the function of the organs. And so the mind is so complex. So we can not say that it's defined by the hardware of the brain. So the complexity has its own rules, has its own levels of working, which can never be explained by the lower layers. So that it makes it more difficult to say that we are kind of deterministic or machines.
Okay. I'll take a shot at part of it. So I'm really happy with a leveled or layered view of reality, and I think that you're going to get explanations at higher levels that you can't get at lower levels, just what you said. I think the causation goes across at levels, at different levels, and the simplest theory about all this is a certain kind of identity theory where you just identify, say, the mental states, like intentions, with brain states. And it's easier to explain things in terms of intentions, explain behavior, than it is in terms of brain states, so we do that. If we identify those states, then it is those states that are doing the causing. So you can count it as mental causation, if you like, or physical causation. So I think everything you said, I'm happy with. Now, about the causation versus correlation, I don't think I made any causal claims. So that's probably a question for you. I think that's true, unless I made one I forgot. But
no, I think it's a general issue in neuroscience and in psychology as well, determining causation. We try to determine causation, but only sometimes we only have correlational measures. So that's definitely a valid point for a lot of issues.
Wow. Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. What a wonderful point to leave it on, causation or correlation, which. And what I would like to do is to thank our speakers very much. The unpacking of free will, the unpacking of agency was beautifully demonstrated, very clear for us, and there is much for us to talk about after lunch in our groups. And so I'd like you all to thank our speakers very much indeed for a simply fantastic morning. Thank you.